At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
I say it all the time, but look, do not take it from me. Take it instead from this guy.
You know, a lot of what we're seeing in the last 90 days is because of Delta. We were on a path to a very different place. Delta put us on a different path.
It's Fed Day, gang, from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 3rd of November. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Item number one from Jerome Powell and the gang at the Federal Reserve wrapping up their meeting this afternoon, something that has come to be called the taper.
At today's meeting, the committee judged that the economy has met this test and decided to begin reducing the pace of its asset purchases.
Those asset purchases, mortgage-backed securities and treasury bonds to the tune of $120 billion a month, are going to start slowing down, $15 billion less every month, month by month, until they're not buying anything new anymore by next summer or so if, as central bankers like to say, as you're about to hear, conditions warrant.
We are prepared to speed up or slow down the pace of reductions in asset purchases if it's warranted by changes in the economic outlook.
It's kind of a big deal, TBH, this taper is. The Fed pulling back, slowly to be sure, but pulling back nonetheless on some really significant support for this economy. What's that? What about raising rates, you say? There's all this inflation you keep hearing about? Yeah, no.
We don't think it's a good time to raise interest rates, though, because we want to see the labor market heal further.
Because, yes, the T word.
Really, for us, what transitory has meant is that if something is transitory, it will not leave behind it permanently or very persistently higher inflation.
It's going to take a while, Powell said again today, for inflation to stabilize. And transitory does not mean those higher prices all go away. But
we will use our tools over time to make sure that that doesn't become a permanent feature of life. Really, that's our one of our principal jobs, along with achieving maximum employment.
And also, finally, from Chair Powell, this.
I think there's room for a whole lot of humility here as we try to think about what maximum employment would be. We're going to have to see some time post-COVID so that we know, or post-Delta anyway, to see what is possible.
I'm telling you, Delta's in charge of this economy. Honestly, other than the taper announcement, though, today's press conference was pretty much what Powell has been saying this whole time. Okay, up Constitution Avenue from where the Fed is to Capitol Hill now, fiscal policymakers, as Fed chairs like to refer to congresspeople, Democrats negotiating President Biden's yet-to-be-settled social spending plan have reached a deal to lower the cost of some prescription drugs for older Americans. A cap on out-of-pocket drug spending for seniors, and for the first time, Medicare would be able to negotiate prices directly with drug makers. For a very few prescription drugs, to be clear, but as Marketplace's Amanda Peacher reports, it is kind of a big deal.
When Medicare establishes a rate for, say, a visit to a doctor, other health insurance providers tend to follow.
The old saying goes that when Medicare sneezes, the healthcare system catches a cold.
Larry Levitt is with the Kaiser Family Foundation.
And that's because Medicare controls so much of the money in the system.
That negotiating power would only be for a handful of drugs, but it could still be a significant move, says Mariana Socal with Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health.
You have a few drugs that are driving a lot of the spending, either because they are very expensive or because a lot of people are taking these drugs.
The pharmaceutical industry's main lobbying group, Pharma, has consistently and successfully fought proposals to give the government negotiating power on drug prices. It spent more than $22 million lobbying Congress so far this year and says this new deal threatens innovation in drug research and development. But Rena Conti, professor at Boston University, points out that highly profitable new drugs won't be affected. Price negotiations will happen
only for products that have been on the market and available for sale in the U.S. for a while.
Conti says drug companies have already recouped costs for developing the drugs that would be up for price negotiation by the government. I'm Amanda Peacher for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, I am kind of running out of different ways to frame this, so I'm just going to say it. Traders don't care about nothing of late except buying stocks. More record highs today. Details, numbers, all y'all know the drill. The through line at the climate talks in Glasgow today has been money. How countries are going to pay for their commitments to reduce carbon emissions, and when and how developed economies are going to finally make good on their promise, lo, these years later, to come up with $100 billion a year in public and private financing to help developing countries cut emissions and adapt to climate change. Public financing you get, right? A legislature approves, the executive disperses. But private investment in climate change? Marketplace's Samantha Fields explains how to get more of that kind of money going.
Private companies are already investing billions of dollars a year in climate-related projects, much of it in wind, solar, and other renewable energy. But Sanjay Patnaik at the Brookings Institution says a lot more private investment is needed.
Because when we look at the scale of the climate problem, both mitigation and adaptation, the willingness to make money available by governments is not even close enough to what we need.
There are things governments could do, he says, to get companies to invest more, including putting a price on carbon emissions and subsidizing research and development of new technologies, which can be expensive and risky.
Helping kickstart these R&D efforts through direct government subsidies can help sometimes. And I think we've seen that, for instance, with the development of the COVID vaccine, where a lot of initial government money helped develop those very quickly.
But while private investment is a critical part of addressing the climate crisis,
it shouldn't be used and it can't be used to distract also from the need for public investments.
Brandon Wu at the nonprofit ActionAid USA says governments in developed countries also need to invest a lot more in helping developing countries adapt to climate change.
Private investment is simply not going to reach the poorest and most vulnerable communities because there's just not a return on investment. You cannot make an investment case for investing in the resilience of a tiny rural community that has no money.
Or helping it recover after a major hurricane or wildfire. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
The changing climate means that we, which is to say humanity, we are all going to have to change our behavior. We just are. And the bigger a polluter a country is, the more the people and the businesses in that country are going to have to change. China is, at the moment, the world's biggest polluter, and it has promised to be carbon neutral by 2060. Far away, though that might seem, as Marketplace Jennifer Pack reports, the changes over there are already happening.
Luoyang City in central Henan province is an ancient capital, cultural center, and a major industrial hub. When I land, there's a thin sheet of smog over the skyline. The sky clears up by the time I reach a canal lined with willow trees where retiree Li Cheng is fishing.
The government has controlled air pollution well. In the past, there were lots of smoggy days. Now there are more days with blue skies.
He says that's thanks to good government policy.
not only by moving factories, but also controlling emissions from cars.
Now China's government is pushing further to go carbon neutral. This cab driver says all taxis in the city will soon need to be electric cars. It's not a policy she agrees with, so she didn't give her name for fear of government harassment.
See the blue cars on the road? Those are electric. But electric cars are not suitable to be taxis because we have day and night shifts. There isn't enough time or stations to charge the batteries between shifts.
There are government subsidies for taxi drivers, but investing in an electric car would still be a lot of money for her. She says she'll hang on to her gasoline-powered car a while longer. Climate experts say China needs to switch to renewable energy faster. Videos show a year's worth of rainfall dropping within days back in July on Zhengzhou, a two-hour drive east of Luoyang. In one, floodwaters wash an adult and child down the street past submerged cars and flooded shops. Below ground, waters trapped hundreds of passengers inside flooded subway cars, killing a dozen. Weather is expected to get more extreme as the Earth gets warmer because of carbon emissions. And China is the biggest emitter of all, more than the US, Europe, and India combined. Because a lot of the stuff we use is made in China. Water bottles, cell phones, car parts, you name it. And domestically, the Chinese are building a lot. All this requires energy, and 60% of the electricity here is generated by coal. Moving away from that means huge changes, says energy policy professor Lin Boqiang from Xiamen University.
We must adjust the industrial structure, try to reduce the size of high energy consumption industries such as copper and aluminum. They consume a lot of power, but don't contribute much to the GDP.
Going carbon neutral has created opportunities for those with carbon emissions expertise, like Wang Jun.
The top salary in the industry before 2020 ranged from $47,000 to $78,000 a year. But now there are many jobs that offer over $150,000 annually.
He now works with a polysilicon manufacturer in Sichuan Province in China's southwest.
Most companies have zero experience managing carbon emissions. My job in this group is to get an overview of the carbon emission situation, which equipment have carbon emissions, what kind of greenhouse gases are emitted. It's basic but fundamental work.
It's also difficult work now that China's factories are working overtime to fulfill demand generated during the pandemic. Electricity use has shot up. There have been power cuts in some 20 provinces. That's stabilized somewhat now because, once again, China has boosted coal use. But this situation is temporary. Again, Professor Lin Boqiang.
If China's government says it'll be carbon neutral by 2060, it will do it because this is a government with continual governance. It is different from the U.S., which can change its leadership every 4 years.
He says China is remarkable making this much progress, given that the country's per capita GDP is 1/6 of that in the U.S. I'm Jennifer Pak from Marketplace.
Coming up,
we had thousands of books to look through.
Knowledge is power, you know. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials up 104 points today, 0.2%, closed at 36,157. The NASDAQ gained 161 points, that is 1%, 15,811. The S&P 500 up 29 points, 0.6%, 46.60. Home furnishings retailer Bed Bath & Beyond bounced up 15.2% today. The company announced some growth measures yesterday. Also said it was forming a partnership with the nation's largest grocery chain, Kroger. Kroger up 5.5% today. Talking about climate and financing earlier, here's the thing. The Ag Economy Barometer from Purdue University, it's their monthly indicator of sentiment among agricultural producers, showed that only about a third of farmers and ranchers polled knew about opportunities to be paid for capturing carbon on their farms. Think about that for a minute. Yield on the 10-year, by the way, 1.60%. You're listening to Marketplace. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdal. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. 185,000 is the macroeconomic number of the day. That is how many jobs the leisure and hospitality industry added in October. The number comes courtesy of the private payroll processor ADP, which figures the economy overall was up more than 500,000 jobs last month. The official number from the Labor Department will be upon us Friday morning. But while we wait, it occurred to us as we were talking over story ideas at our meeting this morning that it's been a while since we checked in on hotels, one of the industries hardest hit by the pandemic, as we all know. And things look a lot different now than they did, say, a year ago. Marriott said this morning profits more than doubled from the same period last year. Hilton's doing just fine, too, thanks. So, Marketplace's Justin Ho has that one for us.
One of the brightest spots for the hotel industry this year has been leisure travel. People simply wanting to get out and booking hotel rooms.
What we're seeing from leisure has gotten really back to 2019 levels.
That's Leni Oberg, Marriott International's chief financial officer. Part of that is because many people have built up a lot in savings. Rich Hightower at Evercore ISI says flexible work policies have made it easier for people to extend their vacations and do a little work from the hotel room.
You know, kind of blending business travel and leisure, you know, midweek to weekend.
Business travel itself has been picking up too, but more slowly. Hightower says many corporations are still hesitant to send employees out on work trips.
I think a lot of that has to do, obviously, with the recovery coming out of a pandemic and concerns around, you know, workers' health being on the road and sort of that duty of care.
And that means a lot of hotel conference rooms are sitting empty.
Those are great pieces of business for us.
Lynn Moorfeld heads the California Hotel and Lodging Association. He says leisure travelers tend to spend their money outside the hotel, but business travelers usually spend more at the hotel.
And that's due to the meeting rooms, the dining. They come in for 2 or 3 days, utilize the hotel services very heavily.
Moorfeld says business conferences and meetings tend to happen in bigger cities, so hotels in urban areas are struggling the most. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
The flip side of industries adding jobs, of course, is that there are still a whole lot of industries and businesses out there doing all they can, including raising pay, yes, to get people to sign on. It's quickly becoming, if it isn't already, a single business's biggest challenge. And that gets us to R.G. Lamar. I met him a couple of years ago on a reporting trip to Georgia. He's a third-generation pecan farmer working on his family farm. And just because it's good to call people up and check in from time to time, we did. R.G., it's good to talk to you again. How you been?
Oh, been good. Lots happened, huh?
Well, it kind of has, both for the world, but also for your company. So look, let's set the stage here. We were down there 3.5, 4 years ago in Hawkinsville, Georgia, walked amongst the pecan trees. And one of the things you got to talking about as we were talking about the state of your industry is how dependent on China you were and how you really kind of wanted to diversify. So talk me through the last 3 years in your pecan business.
So I think we had just gone into the tariff war last time we talked,
and
China had put tariffs on our product. We went from selling pecans for nearly $3 a pound to last year, we sold most of our crop for less than $1 a pound. And that obviously had a big impact on our bottom line. So you mentioned that I was looking for ways to diversify then, and we have really pursued that in a big way. With my business partner, Stephanie Stuckey, we bought her father out in Stuckey's Corporation, the old convenience store chain that you probably know.
I do.
And then we went and bought a pecan shelling facility and a candy making factory. I've picked my family up from Hawkinsville, where we've lived my whole life, and moved near Augusta, Georgia, and we're now running a candy factory and pecan shelling plant.
So in the face of a tariff war and what would turn out to be a global pandemic, you kind of leaned in and said, listen, we got to grow and expand and figure out how to do things bigger.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, for us, a lot of it was in agriculture, you often find yourself just taking a price, and the price you're offered is affected by things you have no control over. And so it's attractive to me to still be in the pecan industry, but in a way that we've got a little bit more control over whether we succeed or fail.
Talk to me about labor costs for a second, specifically in this economy right now, because as you know, as a small business person, or I don't know, maybe you're a medium business person now, labor is a challenge, let's say.
Yeah, that has been extremely difficult. And the plant that we bought is in a very rural area, so there's not a huge pool of labor here to begin with. But we rolled out a new compensation program and brought everybody up to more what we thought was market rates. But just as we were doing that, market rates were going through the roof. Mm-hmm. So we have not found a whole lot of solutions. I mean, we found with Stuckey's there's a tremendous potential for us, but we have a sales funnel right now full of leads that we're just not even touching because we don't have the capacity to supply them because we can't get the people to make the product.
Would you do it again?
Yeah, I would do it again. You know, I do think there's a way forward for us, but it's just going to take longer than I wanted.
So look, the economy's doing pretty well. The pandemic, you know, we're coming through it in whatever fashion that looks like wherever you are in the country. Do you feel at risk for your business until we get through the pandemic, or are you going to be all right until we get to that point?
Well, the crazy thing about this pandemic is consumer demand has been soaring. Yeah. So I actually am very optimistic about our business right now and the demand we're seeing. We just have to figure out all these labor and supply chain issues.
Oh, is that all? Is that all you got to do?
That's all. Yeah. Like I said, I'm optimistic guy.
Fair enough. RJ Lamar, we knew him when he was running his family farm. He's now the president of Stuckey's Corporation down. He's in Augusta. The company, I think, is in Atlanta. RJ, thanks for your time. I really appreciate it.
Always a pleasure.
Books, as we have been telling you, are on the list of the many, many things that have become hard to come by in this economy. Paper shortages, supply chain increased demand, all y'all know the list by now as well as I do of the things that are making new books more scarce than we are used to them being. But what about used books, On today's installment of our series, My Economy, one bookstore trying to turn the page after lockdown.
My name is Chris Capizzi. I'm co-owner of A Good Used Book in Los Angeles, California.
My name is Jenny Yang, and I'm a bookseller, and I live in Los Angeles, California. Chris and I have always been really interested in books. We started collecting all these vintage paperbacks, and they were just really beautiful. And the places that we were buying books typically are also the same places that people buy stuff for, you know, the flea market and vintage clothes. And so someone just kind of suggested, like, why don't you just sell them in person?
You know, we got a small warehouse space. Even looking for the books, we had a friend, one of our best friends now, that, you know, had a storage unit, and we dug for books by ourselves. Basically, we had thousands of books to look through on our own, which during normal, non-pandemic times, a lot of times we're around a lot of people looking for books. At the beginning of the pandemic, we were doing 3 story sales a week, just trying to get the content out. Customer service on a mix of direct message and Google Sheets with no systems in place.
After we decided to sort of go back into the physical world, to the market, we decided to ask our parents for help, and they were able to provide us a small loan for us to be able to create our physical presence back. And I just think that right now, it's been so challenging that I just can't, I'm just so grateful to have, you know, family to kind of be there to support us, even though they know that this is just a challenging business.
Surviving the pandemic through Instagram, basically, and building like our own website, but somehow we were able to get through it.
You know, we are slowly growing and we're going to add more people, but for right now, we're really small. And we have only 80 square feet of retail, but it feels really nice. And I don't know, I don't think that this will be us forever, but this is who we are right now.
We're not just selling books. I mean, we are, but we're trying to use this as a community building tool or like a vehicle for that.
We meet so many exciting and interesting people that we would not have met without selling books and without being, you know, a good used book.
Chris Capizzi and Jenny Yang selling books and maybe a bunch more stuff as well in Los Angeles. This series works best with your help. You know, you can tell us about your economy at marketplace.org/myeconomy. Final note on the way out today. Amy Scott got this to me yesterday, but I couldn't get it into the show. Zillow is laying off 25% of its employees and getting out of the home buying and flipping business. Said the company, quote, "We've determined the unpredictability in forecasting home prices far exceeds what we anticipated." Yeah, welcome to the real estate market, pal. Zillow shares down 23% today. I, though, am still going to keep checking where they value my house. Got to tell you that. All right, we're going. Here's your moment of economic context, though. And don't look now, but oil is taking a tumble. The U.S. benchmark West Texas Intermediate off 3.6% today, down to just under $81 a barrel. Somehow, though, around the corner from my aforementioned house, I'm still paying $5 a gallon to fill up the minivan. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Drew Jostat, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Liana Squillace, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Torrado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.